Welcome to the Main Monitor Radio Hour. This is Stephanie McFeeters, the interim editor of the Main Monitor. The Main Monitor is the nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to informing Mainers through investigative and explanatory journalism and empowering them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Main Monitor. Each month, the Monitor's reporters and editors talk about the stories we are working on, many of which you have likely read in your local newspaper or at themainmonitor.org. Today, I'm joined by Daniel O'Connor, a Report for America Corps member who covers rural government issues as part of a partnership between the Main Monitor and the Bangor Daily News. Dan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You have done a lot of reporting on local budget crises across the state, and that's something we're going to dig into today with a particular focus on what's happening in Washington County.
Yes.
You've also been following how school boards have voted to change policies around transgender students and the groups that are pushing for those changes behind the scenes. So that's something we're going to talk about as well. I'm excited to dive into it. So let's start with this week's vote. It's very fresh. On Tuesday, Washington County asked voters to pass a big bond. Can you just tell us what were they asking for and how did that go?
Yeah, Washington County asked its voters for permission to take out up to $11 million in new debt to issue a bond. That was going to help them refinance their debt. They have a short-term debt that is supposed to be due on December 31st. To pay that off, they need to refinance. And to do that, they needed permission. They failed to get it. And as of today, it looks like 53% of voters said no to that bond and 46.7% said yes. And so they now have to look for other options.
Got it. Yeah. So, and just so listeners are aware, we're talking at Wednesday afternoon. So we're, we just found out the results this morning. And I know, Dan, you had to sort of call around some towns and get the votes from them. And you also were up in Washington County yesterday, and you were talking to a lot of people as they were going to and coming from the polls. What did they have to say? What did people tell you as they were going to make this decision on the county's debt?
So it was pretty split. People have been upset about what happened or what may have happened. It's still sort of unclear how this budget crisis unfolded to a lot of people. And many were in favor of the bond. They decided that they were probably going to have to pay for whatever solution comes about to this budget crisis either way. And so they wanted to get this done, get this over with, and move on. Others, pretty even split. The other half said, no, we don't want to give money to people who've seemingly misused it or used it improperly. And so it seems that they narrowly won out in the end. But people have been, it's been a very tense issue, as it will eventually impact property taxes for people across the county. And this is generally considered to be one of the poorest, if not the poorest county in New England. So that is going to have a big impact on people, especially in communities where people have fixed incomes.
Yeah, absolutely. Is that something that people brought up to you yesterday, this sort of pocketbook concern, or how, you know, how informed were people about what was going on? I mean, you said some people sort of had a sense. I mean, none of us know exactly what happened, which is something we'll get into, but how informed did people seem as they were going to make this decision?
That seemed pretty split too. Some people were, you know, well aware, and others were like, yeah, I didn't really know much about that, but I voted this way, which, you know, happens. But yeah, people were anxious about their tax impacts, but more so, people said they're concerned with the county's ability to manage this money going forward after what happened in the past, which I'm sure we'll get into. And so it was sort of a principal vote for some people. Like, they didn't want to give the permission to take on new debt to
Sure.
the county government. And others were more pragmatic and just wanted to get this passed. But the no vote obviously won out.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's take a step back and sort of talk more about, what we know about this actual budget problem that Washington County is having. How did you first hear about it?
I want to say it was a Facebook post. The Machias Valley News Observer had covered this somewhat, just in their usual local meetings coverage. And I thought that's interesting. It raised some questions for me. I had just covered much smaller, but technically similar story in Waldo County with funds being used there. And so I just sort of leapt into what's going on here in Washington County and or there in Washington County. And it turned out to be quite complicated. And I've been working on that ever since.
Yeah, no, it's been really interesting to follow. And I think there are still some big questions out there. As you've called, former and current officials, what have you learned? And can you just, for folks who I think everyone listening is probably somewhat familiar with this problem by now, but for folks who maybe aren't, can you just sort of walk us through what we know and what the problem looks like?
Yes. So the problem started years ago, around 2020. The county commission, which I should say is made up of completely new people this year. All three commissioners were not on the commission until this year. The prior county commission had decided to institute a policy that they've called carryovers, which is when they look at the county budget and whenever there's money left over, like a surplus for a department, they carry it over from one budget to the next to basically reduce the amount that they have to raise the next year, to keep people from being discontented with their taxes. That was a problem because nobody was actually checking that the money existed. People were reporting surpluses that apparently weren't there, and they were being carried over across multiple years. And that has led to this budget crisis, essentially, because Washington County then spent all of its money. In the summer, it ran out of money, or it came very close to running out of money. And it was reported that they would not be able to make payroll for the next week at some point in June, I believe it was. And so they had to take out emergency short-term debt with a local bank, and that is what they are now struggling to pay off. I think that's the gist.
That's a good gist. And how much money are we talking about here?
Yes.
And how does that compare to sort of their annual spending?
So the short-term debt that they owe, by February, but by statute, they're supposed to pay it by December 31st. They owe $8 million. And that's kind of typical for, it's a little bigger than usual, but the county takes out loans every year because they operate on a January to December calendar year. Whereas most of the towns, which sort of directly fund the county through local property taxes, they get those taxes in the late summer and in the fall. So they take out annually tax anticipation notes, which are short-term debt to cover them until they get the tax money to come in. This time, the tax anticipation note was too big. They have to pay $8 million by February, or they will default. And that is where they're at. And that's a pretty sizable sum of money for the county. Counties don't provide that many services in Maine. So the annual county budget in the past has been around $10 million. And so now they have $8 million just in debt.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about what are these services that the county provides? Because you're right that the county government in Maine is pretty weak. There's a lot more power at the town level and at the state level, and that's different than how it works in other states. And that's something we saw come up a lot when the American Rescue Plan Act money was dispersed during COVID. So what, yeah, what are the services we're talking about that they need this money to fund?
So the counties provide a number of services, some of them legally mandated and some of them not, but generally they're in the public safety arena. The Washington County, like all counties, is obligated by law to provide a sheriff's office and fund that and support the county or shared jails. That sort of thing. They fund 911 dispatch and the DA's office. And so a lot of that spending is mandated in state law, but now they're facing this fiscal cliff where they cannot pay for it if they do not have literally dollars in their bank account. So that's put them in a uncomfortable situation where they're, possibly going to be forced to figure out how to keep the lights on in the places where they need to. And it's particularly important in rural places like Washington County because there are wide areas of the county that are unorganized territory where, for example, plowing, which would normally be done by a city government or a town government, is done by the county because there is no town government. So it's particularly important in Washington County that the county is functioning, at least on some level. And that is the problem, ultimately.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I know you went to a county commissioner's meeting in Machias shortly after this all came to light this summer. Can you tell us what was the reaction there and sort of what was the discussion like? Just paint a picture for us about what that was like.
It was very tense. It was in a courtroom at the Machias County Courthouse, and it was packed, standing room only, with people from all over the county, many of them municipal officials and concerned citizens, etc., who came mostly to ask questions. And it kind of took a Q&A form eventually, which is not common for official meetings. Lots of people lined up for public comment. Some of them were, condemning the government for misusing funds. Others were just more curious. But it took on this sort of Q&A format where, I suppose, to their credit, the county commissioners were sort of answering people's questions, going back and forth with them about what happened, what they know, what they don't know. And that did manage to relieve some tensions, but overall, I would still say that the mood by the end of the night there was pretty tense. People were worried about their taxes going up significantly. And there was a lot of just incredulity, I guess. People were confused how this could happen for years without anybody checking, without anybody noticing, because a common thing you would hear was, if I did this, I would notice it would be a problem. Or if my business did this, we would go under. So people were very shocked that this would happen and pretty outraged.
Yeah, I mean that makes a lot of sense. And let's talk about that checking piece of it because county budgets are supposed to be audited every year, right? And
Yes.
that's part of how this came to light is that there was an audit. Tell us about that.
Yes, so there every city and county budget is supposed to be audited annually, but there's a shortage of auditors in the state, and so a lot of counties, I think most of them, are years behind on their audits. Washington County finished their 2021 audit earlier this year, and in the process of doing that audit, the auditor realized that some things weren't adding up. The bookkeeping was a little bit messy and inconsistent. And he asked around and was able to figure out that this carryover policy was causing problems. And it became clear around the fall of 2024 that they had a problem. It didn't become quite clear how bad that problem was until even after the audit came out, which was in the spring of 2025. And now the county is working with its books and trying to plan a budget based on unaudited numbers because, as they have been for several years now, they're still behind. And so That's also caused a lot of frustration and uncertainty because people have been concerned that the county commissioners and the budget advisory committee in the county are planning with numbers that haven't been checked. And so they're working on getting more audits done, but still they're, on 2022.
Got it. And you just mentioned the budget advisory committee and the commissioners are, thinking about these numbers. And it strikes me that we should maybe just describe who the players are. So who is responsible for, for the budget in a county?
Yes. So the budget advisory committee is made up of town officials across the county, and they meet every so often and craft the budget and propose it sort of back and forth in a back and forth process with the county commissioners, which is like a panel of three elected officials that run each county. And ultimately, it is up to the commissioners. Each county is a little bit different, and Washington County is complicated. There's all sorts of mechanisms with which the budget advisory committee and the commissioners can sort of try and thwart each other. But ultimately, it sort of comes down to what they agree the budget is going to be.
Got it. Yeah, no, each county is a little different. And I honestly didn't fully understand that until our Western Maine correspondent, Ben Hanstein, wrote a piece for us recently about, some drama happening between the Budget Advisory Committee in Franklin County and the commissioners there. And there's a dispute there over sort of who has the final say over the budget. And he did a good piece on that and sort of laid out how it works there and how it works in each of the different counties. And but yeah, I wasn't totally clear on that before either. Who are the other players that, may have had some involvement in this budget crisis?
So the county had the same treasurer since 1999. Jill Holmes, if you're listening, call me. We haven't been able to get in touch yet. But she resigned in the fall around the time that all of this was becoming clear. And ultimately, through our reporting, we found that she had approved improper transfers of funds from the Unorganized Territory Fund to the General Fund. It also appears that somehow, the American Rescue Plan Act funds for the county were spent as the county was running out of money. That's all still kind of unclear. County commissioners have asked the state and federal governments for an investigation into the past use of funds, so that will hopefully become more clear in the future. But yes, so there were others involved as well.
Got it. Okay. No, that's helpful to lay that out. And I know there are definitely some questions, some big questions that are still unanswered. You are listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. Today, I'm joined by Report for America Corps member Daniel O'Connor, who reports on rural government for the Maine Monitor and the Bangor Daily News. We're talking about his reporting on Washington County's budget crisis. So, we've talked a lot about, what we know about the crisis and what the reaction has been since it was revealed. Voters this week rejected the bond measure, which was, it seems like, their main plan. What's next? What's sort of on the table?
Lots of questions left and not a lot of time to answer them. Yes, so the county commissioners and the budget advisory committee had a meeting today that lasted very long. I'm sure it was not fun, where they sort of looked at what their options are because as of the day before the election, they had not really set out a plan B. So with the bond no longer available to them, that would have been their easiest way out of this crisis, but now they're sort of scrambling a little bit to figure out what's next. One budget advisory committee member just told me that they're looking at not paying the loan back by the December 31st deadline, which is a statutory deadline, not the deadline from the bank, which would put them in violation for a couple of days, and then hopefully allow them a chance to take out a new loan to repay the old loan. It's not clear what exactly those terms would look like. Probably they would get not so favorable interest rates on that, but that is something they're looking at right now. And ultimately, it looks like they're probably going to have to add that $8 million onto next year's budget. So on top of everything else and the usual budget increases that come, they're pretty massively increasing the budget, or they may need to massively increase the budget to make up for this hole. And I'll remind you that the ordinary budget for the county is around $10 million, and they're adding eight on top of it.
Right. And one of the things that's interesting about the county budget, and I think this has come up a little bit in the debate there, is that unlike local town budgets, the county budget is not voted on by the population at large, right? Can you talk about how that's come up, and is there sort of some frustration with that given what's happened here?
So, unlike towns, there's no referendum to approve county budgets, which causes some frustration because ultimately the county budget sets an amount of money that towns will have to pay to the county, which impacts their budget discussions. Representative Will Toole, a Republican from East Machias, proposed a bill title for the state legislature that would have allowed for counties to hold budget referendums rather than to allow their usual processes to take place. That was rejected by the Legislative Council. Will Toole may appeal that, so we're still waiting to see how that will go, but that is an option that county commissioners have told me they're open to, or at least a county commissioner at least has told me that he would be open to that.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. And another change that has been floated is thinking about going back to this position of the treasurer, right? What does that discussion sort of looks like?
So there's been a lot of discussion, including at that fall meeting where a lot of frustrated voters came out, about removing the requirement that there's an election for the position of treasurer. Treasurers deal with money. People want them to be good with money. And sometimes when you have an election, you don't necessarily get those qualifications. We also did some research, and across the state, many counties haven't had a contested election for their treasurer's race in many years. Jill Holmes, the treasurer from Washington County, who had served since 1999, never faced a contested election except for before her term in 1992 when she lost an election. So there's real questions about qualifications and about the logic of having this be an elected position. And Washington County in the past, in the 20th century, had considered changing this, but failed to do so at referendum twice. But now it sounds like people are ready to do that.
And I think one of the things you found in your reporting is that when they considered this in the past, no one else had done it, right? And now there is actually some other examples they can look to in Maine.
Yes, so there are three counties in Maine now that appoint their treasurer. Knox County stopped after a 2004 charter referendum, which changed the rules there. They were the first, followed by Androscoggin and Cumberland counties, who both stopped after charter votes in 2012.
Got it. Okay, so there's now some precedent for that.
Yes, and officials in Cumberland County told me during this reporting that it's been running relatively smoothly.
Okay, that's good to know. And so I know another one of the options that has been, that Washington County has looked at is this idea of declaring bankruptcy, but that's currently not legal for them to do. Is that right? Can you tell us about
That
that?
is right. Bankruptcy is a federal process, but the Supreme Court long ago ruled that the states need to approve of governments declaring bankruptcy. The state has to authorize counties or municipalities declaring bankruptcy, and Washington County might have to do that, but the state of Maine has not passed any law that would allow them to do that. So there was a proposal by State Senator Marianne Moore, a Republican from Washington County, who put a bill title through for the next session that would allow that to happen. That was approved by the Legislative Council. It's not clear whether or not they would get that done quickly enough to help Washington County, because again, the time frame is pretty tight here. But that is something that officials in Washington County say that they would perhaps consider. Dave Burns, one of the commissioners, said he's not really ready to commit to pursuing bankruptcy. He doesn't like that option. But officials, the legislative delegation from Washington County wants to pursue this, even if Washington County manages to resolve its problems without declaring bankruptcy.
Okay. So is that, do you think that's one of the sort of main options that's on the table right now, or what are some of the other things that are under discussion?
Bankruptcy is definitely one of the major options. It would help them refinance their debt under a court-supervised process. However, it doesn't sound like currently the Budget Advisory Committee is looking at that as its main option. They're primarily looking at holding off on repaying the loan until after the statutory deadline, repaying it before the bank's deadline in February, and then adding that $8 million to the budget. So that looks like it's shaping up to be plan A based on my conversations, but there's definitely a possibility of a bankruptcy.
Okay. Well, this has been really interesting. Is there anything we have missed sort of on the Washington County side of things before we turn to what's been happening elsewhere that you think it's important for people to know?
Yeah, I think some of the arguments around passing this bond were that effectively the towns had been undertaxed for years. That is effectively true. They were supposed to be charged more because they were charging them based on surpluses that did not exist. But I think that resonated very poorly with people. It felt like sort of what, we're not taxed enough. So I think that sort of contributes to this being a part of the broader tax discontent we've seen across Maine. And yeah, so yeah.
And the tax implications right now are that, I mean, potentially people are looking at a tax hike of 30 to 40%. Is that right?
So it could actually be much worse than that. It was going to be about 30% if the bond passed.
I
The Budget
see.
Advisory Committee had been preparing for the budget as if the bond was going to pass. Obviously, it did not, and now they're sort of back to the drawing board. But if they add that $8 million, that's on top of what they were already expecting. So it could be as high as $20 million in the next budget, and that's roughly double what it normally is. But again, it's all very early and the numbers are yet to become clear.
Got it. Well, they have a lot on their plate
Their
to
work is cut
figure
out for them.
out.
Yes.
Yeah. And I know you'll keep following it. Well, so Washington County, obviously is having a tough time right now, but it's not the only local government that has had some budget challenges this year or where we've seen this tax discontent that you mentioned. Can you tell us a little bit about what's been happening in Lisbon? Because that's another race that you looked at on Tuesday. What's been happening there?
Yeah, so across the state this summer, school districts had a really hard time passing their budgets thanks to more of that tax discontent. Lisbon has been one of the most interesting districts because it was still trying to get its budget passed until November. It's one of two districts that had failed to get their budget passed.
Normally, the votes would happen in June, is that right?
Yes, they
Yeah,
usually
so
happen
it's.
in summer. And so Lisbon had two votes. This was their third on Tuesday. It did pass, But it's been a really interesting debate, and it has changed the makeup of the town's government pretty dramatically, and I think it will continue to do so. But yes, the Lisbon's town budget is passed by the town council, but the school budget is passed by a referendum. The town budget was similar to Washington County, accounting for errors and previous decisions to and had to increase pretty dramatically, roughly 20%. The number has varied a little bit, but the tax levy was going to go up for a lot of people in Lisbon as a result of the town budget, partly because the prior year the town had decided not to raise taxes and instead spent its rainy day fund, or spent out of its rainy day fund to make up for increases that would normally just go straight to the taxpayers. So effectively, you had 2 years of tax increases in one, and that really set people off and caused sort of a taxpayer revolt in town. There was a push to petition to the town council that in the future they would have referendums on the town budget. It was determined by the town council that that was too severe of a change to be made in one vote by the town council. So they ended up holding a referendum on whether or not to create a charter commission, which would then be able to implement that kind of drastic change. That commission referendum passed as well. So it looks like there will be some dramatic changes coming potentially in the next years. That'll be a slow process, but one that lots of conservatives and people concerned about taxes have pushed for in Lisbon.
Got it. So that's something that's probably going to take a few years to discuss, though. Is that right?
Yeah, it'll take a long time to put forward a plan for a new town charter if they put forward such a plan. Right now, we don't even know who the members of this commission are going to be. So it's very early, but it's sort of the first change that people have been pushing for as a result of this town budget. But there will be some more immediate impacts. A slate of conservatives ran for the town council. There were four open seats. It's a seven-person council. Four people is enough to essentially take it over. Three of those conservatives won. They're led by Dale Crafts, who ran for Congress against Jared Golden. He has a political action committee, so he's been really drumming up support for low tax causes in Lisbon. So now he's won prominently a role on the town council, along with two of the three allies he was trying to bring with him. The fourth seat that was open went to a somewhat more moderate conservative named Charlie Turgeon, who had petitioned for this charter change and who is also focused on getting the tax burden down. But between the four new representatives, it's likely that there will be a somewhat more conservative budget coming in the future for the next year. For his part, Dale Crafts had promised to cut pretty deeply. He'd said that people wouldn't like him at the end, but he would do what he had to do, speaking mostly for seniors and people with fixed incomes who he says were at risk of being priced out of town by their property taxes. So, not clear what will happen there, but a pretty major change in the board and the town council there.
And that is, this point about folks on fixed incomes and, seniors, that was something that came up a lot in the initial conversations about the school budget, right? There were a lot of people who said, like, this is not something that we're participating in, and it's untenable for us to keep seeing these property tax increases. Is that right?
Yeah, there was a lot of outrage there too. Again, it is similar to Washington County. People were upset about the error, confused about what happened, wanted answers, and didn't want to pay for someone's mistake, frankly. The town voters came forward with a petition to, bring back referendums for town budgets, and of course that ended up going to a charter referendum. Yeah, there's been some really serious taxpayer discontent and some heated town council meetings driven largely by seniors and people on fixed incomes in Lisbon. And the interesting thing about Lisbon's school budget, I should add, is that Generally speaking, people who were voting against the school budget didn't really have any problem with the school or its funding levels. They were mostly there to protest the town budget, which they felt was far too steep.
Right. And because they were voting on the school budget, that was a chance for them to register their complaint, whereas they couldn't do that on the town budget,
Yes.
right?
Yes, and on the November 4th election, because there were conservatives running for the town council and because there was this charter commission referendum, I think that really diffused some of that anger and, released pressure on the school board. So the school budget was passed at that referendum.
So speaking of school boards, I want to turn to some of your other reporting that you have been doing a lot of, which has been looking at Title IX policy changes across Maine. You're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. Today, I'm joined by Report for America Corps member Daniel O'Connor, who reports on rural government for the Maine Monitor and the Bangor Daily News. Today, we're talking about his reporting on Washington County's budget crisis and on the school districts across Maine that are pushing to change transgender student policies. So another thing you've been following, Dan, have been these debates about Title IX and transgender student protections. Before we dive into what districts have done, can you just briefly summarize the fight between the Trump administration and the state over this issue and sort of walk us through the policies that are at the heart of this?
Yeah, so Maine has a law called the Maine Human Rights Act that, among other things, specifies that in public accommodations in schools that you cannot discriminate against someone because of their gender identity. And so that means essentially that in public school sports and private spaces like bathrooms, locker rooms, transgender people get to use whatever they say aligns with their gender identity. That has been a problem for the Trump administration, who, when they, took Washington in January, very quickly passed a pair of executive orders that have been really impacting the discussion here in Maine. One of them recognizing only two genders, the one combating gender ideology, I think it was called, and another one, which was titled Keeping Men Out of Women's Sports, was aimed specifically at getting transgender women out of girls' sports across the country. It ordered the Department of Education to act accordingly and essentially reaffirmed an earlier interpretation of Title IX, the landmark Sex Discrimination Act in education law. And those two things conflict a bit. And Trump threatened to withhold funding from the state over this issue in particular. And that's when Governor Janet Mills had her famous see you in court moment. And so that's what's happening. They're in court right now, working out the difference, trying to figure out what happens next.
Got it. So as that's been happening, there have been several school districts across Maine that have decided to make a change, that have, wanted to align themselves more with the Trump administration's interpretation of this law. How many school districts so far have done that?
So there's various different policy changes that have been made, but eight essentially across the state have made changes to their transgender policy or their transgender rights policy when it comes to sports and other private spaces. So it started with MSAD 70 up in Hodgdon, which made a big news splash in the spring when they changed their policy to specifically bar transgender students from sports teams matching their gender identities, as well as bathrooms and locker rooms. And that sort of became a model for districts across the state. And so now there are eight of these, mostly in rural areas, that have made policy changes in response to the Trump administration and in response to pressure from parents' rights activists as well.
Got it. Yeah, and that's something we're going to talk a little bit more about. I know there have been also a couple districts that have considered these changes and have rejected them. Is that right?
Yes, so Wyndham and Augusta have both rejected these changes recently. Augusta, in particular, has been a very dramatic case of people discussing this issue at the school board meetings. At a recent meeting, people started stripping in protest. But the school
What
board has.
was the point of the stripping?
Yes, so the
Or what were
school
they
board had.
saying as they were doing that?
Well, the school board had just decided that it would not change its transgender policies to the Trump administration's interpretation, at least until this is worked out in courts, which is
Sure.
what lawyers across the state have been recommending to school districts. So, in protest, some conservative activists stood up in the public comment area and began taking off their clothes, stripping down to their underwear. And one person was speaking at the microphone saying, essentially, this is what our daughters feel every time they go into the bathroom and they see a transgender person. It's not clear how many transgender students are in Augusta, but that is the line.
I see. Got it. Well, in terms of, I mean, this is something I think you've asked all the districts that have made these changes. It's just, are there transgender students who are on the sports teams? And it seems like in most cases, there aren't, right? I mean, there are only a few in the whole state that we know of. Is that right?
It's a tough question to ask because you don't want to necessarily get into some minor's medical history. But
Sure.
as far as I'm aware, none of these districts have a transgender athlete playing. And in the entire state, there are very few. I believe it was the Department of Justice in the spring said there were three in the entire state. And like in Augusta, for example, there are likely transgender students. It's a big school district. It's one of the, it's a city. And, but there are no transgender athletes as far as, for example, school board candidates were aware.
Got it. Okay. And I know, the debate has looked a little different in every community. One that I thought was kind of interesting was the debate in Danforth. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, Danforth had a very dramatic debate over this issue. The school had adopted, a lot, like many other schools across the state, a policy, a standard policy provided by the Maine School Management Association that outlines transgender student rights, basically. One teacher, a gym teacher or a health teacher in Danforth up by the Canadian border in Washington County had found out about this policy, said she objected to it for religious reasons, personal reasons, and so she resigned very publicly, stating that this policy was the reason why she was resigning. She got a lot of support from community members. It's a very small, sort of conservative community up there, and people began showing up at school board meetings over that, and ultimately pressured the school board to vote to change that policy, to remove that policy. And shortly after they removed the policy, that school's superintendent resigned, seemingly as a reaction to that move.
You mentioned this a little bit, but through your reporting, you have found that this is a concerted push and that there are two main groups here that are advising parents and encouraging them to get involved with their school boards and sort of, make their opinions heard on this matter. Can you tell us what those two groups are and what their goals are?
The Maine Education Initiative is a project created by the Maine Policy Institute, which is the state's main conservative think tank. They have various projects, they including the Maine Wire, for example. The Maine Education Initiative is led by former State Representative Heidi Sampson, who's sort of a firebrand conservative provocateur type. She has been pushing school districts to change their policies, and that is a big priority for her. The other group is Parents' Rights in Education, which is actually a national group based in Oregon that has a chapter based in Topsom. And their leader, Alan Sarvinus, has been pushing very hard as well. They're a 501c3, so they can't do political activity, but they have been meeting with a lot of people across the state trying to encourage parents to run for school board and to advocate for conservative policy on transgender students in their school districts. And the two groups have become very close and are overlapping in many ways, and have been pushing this across the state.
Got it. And one of the things that the Maine Education Initiative does is they've provided the sample, they've provided sample wording for policy changes that some of these districts have used. Is that right?
Yes, so some of the districts have passed resolutions mirroring or closely mimicking language from the Maine Education Institute. On their website, you can see their policy. It outlines specifically what they want. It demands that the superintendent examine policies for anything that violates their agreed upon interpretation of Title IX, which is what the Trump administration pushes. And yeah.
Got it. And you went to an event that was hosted by these groups toward the end of the summer. Tell us about that. What was that like? Where was it? And yeah, what happened there?
It was hosted by Mossbrook Church in South Paris. There were about two dozen people there. I had talked with Alan, the organizer, in advance. It was a private event, so I wanted to, be sure I was allowed to be there. They had asked that I not interview people, fair enough. And so I didn't talk to many of these people, but I was there, able to take notes and able to just sort of observe what was going on at the meeting. And what I found there was a pretty candid explanation of strategy on this issue from the two groups. And I got a look into what their messaging is and how they're communicating to parents and grandparents.
And how were they? What was that? What was that message?
Their message to parents was that they really have power over school boards and that they should use their voice. And it was a very encouraging environment in some ways, like encouraging people to speak up, and that takes courage. And it also was a lot of focus on how to get the policy passed, how the nuts and bolts of school boards, how they work, something that lots of people do not understand. And Heidi Sampson spoke there about how school board members need to really move fast on this and get things through before any major opposition arises. And also how I believe her words were that the opposition would screech like hyenas, but that, ultimately they're exhaustion would overcome them, and you would be able to get these policies passed. And that has worked in lots of school districts where people connected to these groups, are serving on school boards.
And so, in addition to this effort, which is sort of a district by district, very, kind of from the ground up movement to get these policies changed across the state, there's also now an effort to get this issue on the ballot next year in 2026. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, so there's a third group called Maine Girl Dads that is more of a social group that is led by a school board member in the state, and they have been pushing for a ballot measure. People connected to Maine Girl Dads have signed an application with the Secretary of State that would allow for a ballot measure to take place if they get enough signatures to put it on the ballot in 2026. It looks like they're going to be able to do that. They started collecting signatures on Election Day, coincidentally, and it looks like they already have over 50,000. Organizers are saying they need 67 approximately thousand votes or voters to sign on for that to be placed on the ballot. They need those signatures by February if they want it on the 2026 ballot. If it takes longer than that, which seems unlikely given the pace things have been going so far, it'll be on 2027's ballot.
Got it. So this could be a statewide referendum question next November, which is going to be a pretty big race. It's the midterms. Obviously, there are already some really heated races that are going to be decided then. So it seems like probably a year that we'll see high turnout and a lot of people having to answer this question. Is that right?
Yeah, and it could really drive conservative turnout. This is a winning issue for the Republican Party right now. A majority of people in polls say they do want transgender girls to be playing on separate sports teams from cisgender girls. The numbers are a little bit more split on bathrooms and private spaces, but yeah, this could drive conservative turnout in a critical, nationally important election year for Maine. There's a Senate race that's going to be watched very closely, and yeah, this could really impact turnout.
Got it. And I know in your reporting, you've talked to the folks that are behind these efforts, but you've also talked to folks who, are not so happy about them. What do people on the other side of the issue have to say about these efforts?
Opposition to these efforts has not been super organized. The state has not taken any steps to enforce its law around transgender students, partly because of the ongoing lawsuit. But that has given the green light to a lot of these conservative groups that, now is the time to push. And now we're starting to see that there's been enough visibility around these policy changes that people are starting to, on the left of this issue, wake up to what's happening. We're seeing groups like Equality Maine making statements about how they see this as an unnecessary ballot measure, for example. So the ballot measure, I think, has really sort of jarred people a little bit into realizing that this is more than a school by school issue that will, impact some rural districts that maybe don't have any transgender students, but potentially a real statewide issue. So people are starting to release statements against that, and we'll see how robust that opposition becomes.
Got it. And are there any, what are the things you're sort of watching in this space as you continue reporting on the issue?
I am watching to see if any new districts are changing their policies. That can be tricky. There's a lot of school districts in Maine. If you know of any that have changed their policies or are thinking of them, let me know. I'm also watching these groups to see where they're showing up and where they are campaigning, where they are hosting events, who's attending those events, just to get a sense of who is running for school boards, who is trying to impact school board policy. I will say that in November's election, several candidates who had been associated with Parents' Rights in Education ran for office. It looks like most, if not all of them, lost those races, including in Augusta, where there was a high-profile race. So we're watching to see who gets school board positions, what school board members exist that are already interacting with these groups, and who is agreeing with them, even if they're not interacting with them.
Got it. Yeah, a lot of really interesting things to watch, and we've definitely appreciated your reporting, and this has been a really interesting conversation here today. So thank you, Dan, for
Thank you.
making time. I know it's been a really busy week with the election, so it's good to sit down and talk about this, though.
Yes, I need a nap.
All right after this. Before we sign off today, I just want to quickly plug a new reporting initiative that we launched earlier this month. Oh, it's something we're calling Monitor Local. And it's a reporting initiative that is designed to meet the local information needs of people in towns across Western and Down East Maine with public service reporting on town council meetings, school budget debates, zoning conversations, tax deliberations, and more. It's something that we are publishing alongside the Maine Monitor's investigative and in-depth reporting, and it's being led by longtime Maine journalist Judy Meyer. along with a team of local correspondents. So if you have ideas for local stories, town stories in Western Maine, in Oxford, Franklin, or Somerset counties, or in Washington County, you can write to us and let Judy know. The team published the first set of their stories last weekend on November 1st, and there will be another batch coming out this Saturday in our regional newsletters. We have a newsletter focused on Western Maine and a newsletter focused on Down East Maine. This is something that grew out of listening tours that we led over the summer, where we were in communities across Maine and folks said that they really just wanted more hyper-local coverage. They wanted to know what was happening in their town meetings, what these budget debates looked like. And, you know, these are the things that Dan is getting into, but people wanted them, you know, on a more consistent basis, and they wanted, you know, a lot more coverage. And so that's something we're hoping to provide in a few communities now in Western and Down East Maine. So I hope, you know, if you get a chance to check it out, you will. It's available on our website, themainemonitor.org, and in our Saturday newsletter. So I just wanted to quickly plug this new initiative, which was made possible with grant support from Journalism New England, which is a nonprofit organization that's working to build and sustain local news.
You've been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a collaboration between WERU-FM and the nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. To read Dan's stories and learn more about our reporting, visit themainemonitor.org or thebangordailynews.com. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app, subscribe to the show as a podcast, or download archived shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Stephanie McFeeters, and this is Community Radio WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Thanks for listening.